Welcome to the Annex Wealth Management SWAT podcast. This is episode 102 for Monday, May 6th. Strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. It's insight and perspective for members of the Annex Wealth Management Investment Committee. Joining us today, Dr. Brian Jacobson, Chief Economist. Hello.
Hey, it's good to be here.
And we got Ken Bellinger, Research Analyst. Welcome to you.
Good morning, Danny. So first off, I'd like to thank all the listeners who keep coming back to listen week after week. And if you like what you hear, please share with friends, colleagues, and family. Yeah, we have a lot of fun making these, and your continued tuning in lets us keep doing it. Brian, why don't we kick it off with some economic data next week? What do we got coming our way?
Yeah, so for the week ahead, we have kind of a light calendar, which is nice after the 2 weeks of rather intense data releases, earnings season going on. Earnings season is obviously continuing, but we have the Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey, which is from the Federal Reserve, where they talk to a bunch of bankers and ask them what's going on with Main Street America and with credit conditions and things like that. Always kind of interesting to see what's going on there. We have consumer credit numbers for March coming out on Tuesday, the extent to which people are, still fueling their spending through credit card usage. Thursday, initial jobless claims. That's part of the weekly set of data releases that we look at. And then Friday, University of Michigan, their preliminary reading for May with consumer sentiment. And I think that's one of the interesting things when I look back at what has happened over the past few weeks is consumer confidence, so as measured by the Conference Board, as opposed to consumer sentiment, as measured by the University of Michigan, consumer confidence has really stepped lower. And I think sentiment has as well, but a little bit less so. This whole vibe session thing, so a recession that people are just kind of feeling, but it's not showing up in the data, is continuing. And will that, the hard data begin to really support that? We did get the employment situation report on Friday. I thought that was really interesting as far as it was a 175,000 non-farm payrolls gain, which is a really good number. It's just not as great as what it was over the last year. I think over the last year, it's averaged like 240,000. So stepping down to something that's merely good seemed like maybe it was a little bit of a disappointment, except for stocks and bond markets, I think, really liked it because it means that the Fed, their desire to bring the labor market a little bit more into balance might be coming to fruition here. And so if we kind of jump into the whole, SWOT framework as far as with the strength, I think that, the job market is still strong, but not too hot. And the Fed, they made some changes. They are in this Powell pause period as far as with they're going to be very patient for when it comes time to cut rates. He kind of took rate hikes off the table, not completely, but somewhat, and they decided to taper quantitative tightening. So the balance sheet runoff, instead of letting $60 billion a month in Treasury securities run off their balance sheet, they decided that starting in June, they'll come down to $25 billion. And I thought that was kind of a strength, not only that Powell took rate hikes most part off the table, but then also that balance sheet management, recognizing that there's some, bond market volatility that the Fed isn't really helping matters by allowing the balance sheet to shrink as quickly as what they have. And so maybe they took notice of that. A focus on financial stability has meant that they are going to begin tapering that tightening. So I don't know, from a market's perspective, what are you seeing in terms of strength?
Yeah, certainly. Well, the combination of the Fed on Wednesday last week and then the labor market, certainly on Friday, we really saw yields whipsaw somewhat. Mm-hmm. Beginning of the week, we were kind of popping, and off of last week, we were up almost 20 basis points. It looks like we've given most of that back already.
Yeah.
Just with the somewhat positive indicators, less employment isn't necessarily a positive, but to your point, right, it means that we're at a more neutral functional level, right? So the prospect of hikes coming off the table and then cooling job numbers certainly was a boon for the fixed income market, and certainly as well as equities. We saw really strong performance out of the equity market on Friday. And notably, I'll just hit on Apple here briefly, and only really on the, they're buying back $110 billion of stock. It's the largest buyback program in U.S. history. And, that stock popped even with, frankly, fairly poor iPhone numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of those fortress companies where their balance sheet is just impeccable. And, you know, they're able to do things like this in kind of slower times, if you will.
Yeah, their ability to generate free cash flow is just incredible. And I think that is also one of the things that when people talk about, you know, whether or not valuations are elevated, and they try to draw parallels to previous times in history, like the tech bubble especially, it's like you just got to point at the cash flows, right? Now, a lot of these tech companies, they're actually, you know, cash flow positive in a very rich way, as opposed to back then when it was based, you know, the valuations were based on maybe more hopes and dreams than anything.
The interesting thing for Apple, I think, compared to the rest of the Magnificent Seven, if you will, is that growth wasn't necessarily as baked into kind of the long-term outlook for Apple as I think it was for certainly a lot of these more,
mm-hmm.
you know, AI-centered players. Not that Apple isn't working on AI, they obviously are, but yeah. They certainly weren't, at least in my opinion, they weren't included as much in that bucket, right,
yeah.
If you will, from an investor perspective.
Yeah, I think a lot of investors almost threw in the towel on Apple as far as being part of the AI story when, you know, they were effectively talking to companies like Google and Microsoft outsourcing the AI capabilities to them. And so it's like, okay, well, what are they really going to do? And it'll be fascinating to see whether or not the hardware that Apple produces, whether it's the iPhones, the Macs, or whatever, the extent to which some of the artificial intelligence capabilities can be run natively on those devices, as opposed to right now, most of the time, the stuff, it needs to be run in the cloud. And I remember when I was in college, actually, there was a lot of talk about with computers where they could effectively just be terminals and you would tap into a mainframe back then. And nowadays, it's like, you know, a virtual machine. And so the extent to which you still need that good data connection and all the processing is done remotely. But, you know, can it actually be done on a device? I think that's really the area that I'm most interested to see as far as what develops over the next year or two.
That technology whipsaw back and forth between kind of a central data hub and then getting the data, yeah, being processed kind of at the endpoints, if you will.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
That seems to swing back and forth throughout. You call it history, I guess. You're going back to what, the 1970s?
Yeah, really, it was. Yeah. Well, and that was actually, I think, Steve Jobs, when he was boosted from Apple, he went and started that company, I think it was called Next, with those computers. And that was the idea as far as, oh, will it be distributed technology where it's effectively just, you need a monitor, keyboard, and a mouse, and then you have the actual processing, the bulk of the processing taking someplace on a data farm.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of some of the weaknesses that we're seeing out there, it's not just all strength, even though it does feel that way after, you know, Friday when yields came down, stocks went up. But some of the weakness, there are some signs of cracks in the consumer's confidence and in almost like kind of a crack in the facade of the economy when we get into some of the details of the reports that are out there. When it comes to the employment situation report, the aggregate hours worked, so you take the number of people who are working, multiply it by the number of hours that they work, it actually shrank again month on month in April. Wages were flat for the month when you look at aggregate wages. So you take the hours worked, average wage, that actually didn't increase. And so that is suggesting that consumers might begin to start feeling a bit of a pinch. So if their nominal wages, their total income, isn't really growing all that fast, and you still have relatively high inflation, right? The real purchasing power of your income is beginning to fall. Maybe that's one of the reasons why when we look at consumer discretionary stocks, those have been underperforming the broader market. And so maybe the market itself is beginning to sniff out a little bit of this budding weakness that's out there with consumers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you saw that, you know, perhaps partially in, you know, the Starbucks reports, the one that's, I guess, top of mind for me at the moment, right? Or, you know, their stock dove 10% after earnings on, you know, kind of a weakened outlook, if you will. And, you know, what's the easiest thing to give up? You know, probably downgrading your coffee to brew at home from,
sure,
you know, the lovely drive-thru experience that they do have. You know, the other ripple, which does eventually point to the consumer somewhat, is we saw a lot of weakness out of the trucking and the shipping industry, mm-hmm. where, you know, a lot of those companies went through earnings and reported, you know, fairly weak and slowing data, which is kind of, you know, something we tend to consider as a leading indicator of sorts, if you will.
Yeah, that comes from the whole Dow theory as far as with transportation supposed to be leading like industrials. I did take note of a number of those reporters who are saying about it's a challenging environment. Yet you compare that to in the employment situation report, some of the big job gains were in transportation and warehousing still. So they're still needing to hire. They're still having issues as far as getting to full staffing. But now they're beginning to see almost like that pipeline of shipments as far as, you know, the pre-orders for capacity on the, whether it's the trucks or the railroads on the rail cars, beginning to fall off a little bit. And so it'll be interesting to see how that really shakes out. Is that just a temporary thing? Or is it a prelude to something a little bit bigger and a little bit deeper? One of the other weaknesses, obviously, in terms of currencies, for those who follow that sort of thing, the Japanese yen has been pretty weak, and the Bank of Japan and Ministry of Finance over there had to intervene, or they felt like they had to intervene a couple times this past week in order to stem the fall in the yen relative to the dollar. And, you know, those types of interventions, I always find it fascinating because I actually did my dissertation on that type of work, and it rarely works out well. It's almost like throwing good money after bad, or in the case of the yen, I guess, bad money after bad, just given how weak the yen has been. Unless the fundamentals actually improve, and the biggest fundamental force at work there would be the Bank of Japan's policy rate versus, say, the Federal Reserve's policy rate. So unless the Bank of Japan begins to signal that they're going to play a little bit of catch-up with rate hikes, it seems like this intervention that they've done is maybe doomed to fail. So they'll be interesting to see how that continues to play out.
It's funny because, you know, the first intervention came on Monday last week and you saw a pretty significant decline. And that was a holiday. Mm-hmm. So I think the theory, perhaps from their perspective, was this is a less liquid time where we can really make a dent if we go make a big purchase. And by the end of Monday, half of it had already been given back.
Yeah.
So to your point, yeah, it certainly, if you go back throughout history, it wasn't that rapid of a decline where you found out, oh, this really isn't working that quickly.
Sure.
But yeah, certainly, at least at the beginning of the week, it certainly felt like bad money after bad.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was one of the weaknesses. Now let's shift maybe more forward looking to talking about opportunities and threats. When I think about some of the opportunities, I still believe that there are a lot of misperceptions and misconceptions out there about, say, like valuations and seasonalities, things along those lines. Yeah, and even from, like, maybe let's start actually with a macro concept of stagflation. I like how during Chair Powell's press conference, somebody asked him about stagflation. And to paraphrase what he said, he's like, where's the stag and where's the flation, right? Because he actually lived through the stagflation of the 1970s, which was you have very elevated stagnation, very weak growth, very high unemployment, right? So the unemployment rate, if that's high single digits, low double digits, that's the stagnation part of the equation. And then the flation part, the inflation, again, it's was back then high single digits, low double digits. Now we were, in fairness, you know, about a year and a half, 2 years ago, at, you know, 9% inflation, but it didn't get up to the double digits as to what we had in the 1970s, and it's come down to something more with a three handle on it or two handle, depending upon if you're looking at the PCE, personal consumption expenditure measure, or the CPI, the consumer price index measure. But, you know, it's elevated inflation, and you still have a very low unemployment rate. And yes, growth in the first quarter was 1.6% annualized according to the gross domestic product numbers, but there is no real stagnation part to that. And the flation part is a very mild or almost like a kind of a light beer version of what we had during the heavy lager experience during the 70s.
That's a great way of putting that. Now I gotta go get a beer.
it's noon somewhere.
Absolutely. But yeah, you know, to your point, you know, the economy is still growing, you know, employment's still pretty strong. And, you know, at this point, you know, you can argue that, you know, has the Fed made mistakes in the past? I think it'd be pretty easy to argue that the lower for longer policies of the past perhaps weren't the best. Mm-hmm. The good news where we sit now is, you know, we've got, you know, the Fed funds rate north of 5, right? And obviously they're watching these data points like a hawk, which we'll get into briefly, but they've got some ammo at this point. You know, I think if you would have hit this back in 2020, 2021, something like that, you, perhaps a bit more problematic, but you know, they've got some tools available at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's one of the opportunities, is everybody's convinced that the Fed has made a mistake, and maybe they will, but you know, maybe this patient pause of Powell is actually not a bad thing, right? Now, another one of those misconceptions that I think might provide an opportunity for investors to perhaps just calm down a little bit, which is maybe an opportunity, is when, related to the Fed, there was something in the late 1990s called the Fed model that became fairly popular. And I see this brought up a number of times, where it was mentioned once in a report from the Federal Reserve, and then Ed Yardeni kind of ran with it and said, oh, this is the Federal Reserve's model of valuations. And maybe that was a little over exaggeration on his part. But the idea was that if you take the earnings yield, so take the price to earnings, and you invert it, right? So earnings to price. So that's an earnings yield. A lot of people like to compare that to the yield on the 10-year Treasury security. And they'll say, oh, based on this measure, stocks are really expensive because of how much Treasury yields have moved up. Now, the problem with that is a stock is not a bond, right? If you think about the Treasury security, the yield on that, that's a fixed series of payments going into the future. There's no growth there. Whereas with stocks, you're not only expecting to get the earnings, but also the growth in the earnings. So that growth part is a really important number that you have to kind of add to it to give any sort of, I think, theoretical or even empirical basis. And so I like to look at earnings yields relative to the real 10-year Treasury. Okay, so you strip out the inflation compensation part. So it's a little bit, it's not exactly an apples to apples comparison, but it's more like comparing apples to pears as opposed to apples to, you know, sneakers, because really there is no comparison between the yield, earnings yield on stocks and Treasury security yields. And when we do that sort of comparison, valuations are actually pretty average. You know, there are obviously exceptions to that, but a lot of this is just driven by, remember, earnings have been surprising to the upside. And now, will they continue to surprise to the upside at the pace at which they have? Maybe not. But I think that a lot of people are still just kind of waiting for that other shoe to drop, as far as we're going to go into a recession, or there's going to be that drop in earnings growth. And if that doesn't materialize, if companies are actually resilient with their margins and their growth, to me, that presents a pretty decent opportunity.
One of the things too that, and this is a hat tip to Jason Cooper, our new director of equity research, you know, he mentioned that he's been hearing at conference calls as kind of a reduction of sales guidance, but a lot of that being related to a strong dollar.
Yeah.
Potentially some opportunity there, you know, with weak data, renewed expectations of easing, eventually we'll, you know, and frankly on Friday, perhaps a little bit, right? A reversal of that stronger dollar, you know, as yields in the US come down, you know, the natural side effect of that is, I guess we'll exclude Japan from this potentially. But in theory, the idea is, right, you know, lower yields, weaker dollar. So as we, you know, we've now priced in a second cut from the Fed by the end of 2024. And, you know, I think our expectation is no one knows the hour, right? But we expect those cuts are coming.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, I wouldn't necessarily expect this dollar strength to be persistent, you know, for several years, right? So in the end, that'll be a benefit to some of these companies that perhaps got hit a little bit based on the weakened guidance just solely because of that strong dollar and their international exposures.
That's right. Yeah. And really that headwind of a strong dollar could turn into a tailwind if we do get that weaker dollar, and especially for those larger cap companies that are more globally oriented. And a lot of it does depend upon what the Fed will do, what they'll signal. And so maybe that turns more to the threats side of things, as far as how the Fed still seems intent on driving the car by looking through the rearview mirror, right? They talk about being data dependent, and we know that the data comes out with a lag. And if they're just going to react to every data release, it's like reacting to what has happened behind you as opposed to reacting to what's in front of you. That can be very dangerous, especially since the data itself maybe isn't as reliable as it used to be. When we look at, you know, the employment situation report, the household survey that gives us the unemployment rate, the response rate for that has dropped down to about 70%. Now, pre-COVID, it was at 85%, right? So you have fewer people that are responding to the surveys. For establishments, that's where we get the non-farm payroll number. That's even worse. Pre-COVID, the response rate there was 60%. Now it's down to about 43%, right? So you have lower response rates. Maybe it's a little bit less reliable. So one of the dangers, of course, is that the Fed, if they're still being very reactive to the data, and if the data are bad, that can lead to bad outcomes. So I think maybe that's one of the bigger threats that's out there.
Yeah, basic statistics, right? The lower the sample size, the higher the margin of error.
And yeah.
Yeah, that's certainly a case there. And maybe I'll blame Apple for that a little bit, because when I get those phone calls and it says, spam risk or telemarketer, sure. I'm like, nope, absolutely not.
Well, I also then mark them as junk, right? Uh-huh. And so that way it never even rings through a second time.
So my personal apologies to Jay Powell for the impact I've personally had on these survey numbers. But kind of diving past that a little bit, I think the big question here is still, can something potentially break? Last year we had the regional bank scare. We've seen loan defaults starting to rise a bit. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't call them alarming, but certainly a bit of an uptick. Interest coverage ratios are, the lowest we've seen in 20 years if we exclude that brief COVID window where, earnings just went haywire for a moment in time. And the rise of private credit, and I don't necessarily mean this as a knock on private credit, but it's more, it adds a level of, opacity, if you will, mm-hmm. to what we're seeing out of fixed income, because those private lenders have the ability to renegotiate with folks that perhaps are in trouble on their debt. And that doesn't really get seen a whole lot publicly, right?
That's true.
They can kind of keep that close to the vest and don't have to report on it necessarily as frequently or as often. And it's not public knowledge.
Yeah. And that really, if you think back to the 80s where there was a talk about the shadow banks, right? I mean, that was the idea, is it's taking place in the shadows. There's a lot of information to know. Are default rates really going up? What is the actual credit quality within these different structures? And if you don't have that type of disclosure, I think it was Justice Brandeis from the Supreme Court who once said that sunlight is a great disinfectant. And it's true. If you do get that transparency, that type of sunlight, we can then take that as a signal or information about what's really going on as far as with maybe the outlook. And now we're not getting that type of information quite as readily because of the role that private credit and private equity is playing.
Yeah, to be clear, it's not necessarily a knock on private credit. I think,
for the right folks and people,
there's absolutely a place for it.
Yep.
It's just kind of the impact it's having on our ability to truly see what's going on, in the market. One other threat I guess I'll throw out there is just labor. And, mm-hmm. besides the job numbers themselves, I think we've got two potential issues. One, misskilled labor, mm-hmm. right? Especially as we're trying to bring a lot of these infrastructure projects online, and we just don't have enough of the right kind of people to push these jobs forward in a more, called, I guess, a cost-efficient manner, right? So you're having to really pay up for the labor to, do things like, roads, internet infrastructure, utility infrastructure.
Sure. Yeah, look at what TSMC, what they had to go through as far as, I think, in Arizona, where they wanted to build a fab. They felt like they needed to bring over people from Taiwan to install some of the equipment just because we have never done it here in the United States. And they were just more comfortable working with people who had experience doing it, right? And it takes time to get that type of experience. And, to the extent to which does our workforce have the right skills? I think that they will. It takes time. But, right now it does still kind of look like where are the areas where there's a mismatch between the applicant's skills and the employer's needs. In a lot of the surveys that I've been reading through, it still continues to be in the trades, plumbers and construction workers and electricians, masons, all that stuff. Extent to which do workers not only have the right skills, but then also are they in the right place? The housing market situation still is not fantastic. If you want to relocate from one area to another, you have to find a place to live. And how hard is that these days? And so with the labor market, for the matching to actually work, it's about having the right people with the right skills in the right place.
To your point with the housing market, to the plus side of, people locking in all of these 3% mortgages back in early COVID, the consumer hasn't been hit as hard by these rising rates. And I think you've seen that in consumer confidence numbers, perhaps over the past couple of years, that might otherwise be higher than you would have expected in a rising rate environment. The flip side of that, of course, is if you're going to move and sell your house at that 3% mortgage, now you're picking up, you know, a 7.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a huge, huge jump in payment for most people. And with, you know, prices also up since, you know, COVID hit, it's a tough mix.
Let's go around the horn, find out what our headlines are. Headline strength this week.
Dovish tilt and buybacks propelling the market forward.
Headline weakness.
Cracks in the consumer facade.
Headline opportunity.
Market misconceptions provide opportunities for outperformance.
Nice headline. And a headline threat.
Bad data and labor issues could lead to some bigger risks.
Annex Wealth Management SWAT Podcast, episode 102. Thank you, Dr. Brian Jacobson, Chief Economist.
Thank you.
Ken Bellinger, Research Analyst. Thank you.
Thank you.
Annex Wealth Management, LLC, is a registered investment advisor. For more information about our firm, please visit annexwealth.com. The information in this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only and is subject to change without notice. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and don't necessarily reflect on those of Annex Wealth Management, LLC. Information presented should not be construed as tax, legal, or investment advice, or a recommendation or a solicitation for the sale of any product or strategy. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from qualified professionals to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. Investments involve risk. Neither Annex Wealth Management, LLC, nor its podcast participants shall be liable for losses resulting from decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on this podcast.